Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino.
That's right. ChumbaCasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Two days before Christmas in 1988, four teenagers set off from Greensboro to Raleigh to squeeze in some last-minute shopping. Their path would take them along Interstate 40, 90 minutes through the heart of North Carolina. Yet what was meant to be a fun outing would instead become a scene straight out of a horror movie, and only three of them would make it home alive. Kenneth Dungy, Darius Bannerman, Laverne Allen, and Kenneth Newkirk were good friends looking for a little fun on a Friday afternoon. Sailing down I-40, the group soon found themselves the targets of a senseless and violent attack when an unknown man appeared behind them. Terrorizing the teens, the driver started with tailgating, but soon grew violent, slamming into their bumper, eventually forcing them off the road where their car spun and flipped down a steep embankment. As witnesses rushed to help, the assailant pulled to the side of the road and surveyed the carnage he had wrought before speeding off into the fading afternoon light. In a matter of seconds, three lives were forever changed and one was extinguished. Had this been a random incident, road rage out of control, or could this have been a racially motivated attack carried out by a killer who wouldn't stop until he'd spilled blood? This is Trace Evidence, episode 159, The I-40 Hit and Run Murder. Welcome to Trace Evidence. I'm your host, Stephen Pacheco. Today we examine a tragic story of four friends who found themselves the targets of a vicious assault that left one dead and another clinging to life. Before getting into the case, just a few notes about the show. Trace Evidence is a weekly true crime podcast focused on unsolved murders and disappearances. You can follow the show on social media on Twitter at TraceEvPod, Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, or by searching Facebook for Trace Evidence. If you're interested in supporting the show and getting some Trace Evidence merch, there's a Patreon at patreon.com/traceevidence, or you can donate directly via PayPal. Visit trace-evidence.com for all social media links, donation options, and contact information. You can submit case suggestions through the website or email me directly at traceevidencepod@gmail.com. Four friends setting off on a holiday shopping trip cross paths with a violent man, and a casual drive transforms into a desperate attempt to survive. This is episode 159, The I-40 Hit and Run Murder. Light winds sailed in from the west, ushering thin wisps of graying clouds in the deep blue afternoon. The threat of rain had lingered all morning, somewhere on the outskirts of the horizon where the mountains meet the sky. Just days earlier, winter had settled over the country, but there in Greensboro, you wouldn't have known it. The sun continued to pour warmly over the lush greenery, the dull hint of a chill riding the mild breeze across heated strips of asphalt and concrete. The holiday season was at hand. Homes and businesses decorated in lights of red and green stood witness to the chaotic rush of last-minute shoppers seeking out that final, perfect gift. The roads were busy, drivers moving towards an endless wealth of shopping centers and strip malls decked out with plastic trees and fluffed cotton snowdrifts. Interstate traffic was moving steadily throughout the afternoon, but for one stretch of road where everything came to a stop. A growing line of cars sat in the eastbound lanes of Interstate 40, where a wall of orange cones, glowing red flares, and the whirling blue and white strobes of the highway patrol stopped further advancement. Curious onlookers craned their necks, trying to peer over the cars in front of them, though had they laid their eyes on the cause of the stoppage, they'd have regretted the sight. Thick skid marks veered out from the right lane before digging twin ditches into the dirt and grass just off the pavement. Shattered glass and strips of metal littered the roadside, a trail of wreckage leading along a steep embankment where dozens of police and emergency technicians scrambled towards the vehicle. It was difficult to discern what make and model it had been before it flipped, rolling several times to land in a crush of twisted metal and broken glass. It was black, at least it had been, before it had come careening off the interstate at a high rate of speed. Two passengers had been ejected from the vehicle, broken bones and bloodied faces lying in the grass a few feet away. They were alive, though consciousness seemed to drift in and out, rising to register awareness only long enough to succumb to pain, sinking back into the darkness. Yet, they were the lucky ones. Back in the car, two others were trapped. The driver pinned into place, his leg bleeding profusely as special tools were employed to pry him from the steel trap. Just behind him, in what was left of the back seat, the fourth passenger lay still. He hadn't moved, hadn't screamed, hadn't had time to react. He was gone, his life extinguished in a matter of seconds between the road and the field. Investigators arriving at the scene assumed it was just another accident, tragic and all too common. A driver moving along at a high speed loses control, flies off the road, the loss of traction, a quick turn of the wheel as they hit the embankment, and moments later the crushing steel, screaming glass, and revving engine are replaced with an eerie silence. This time, though, it was different. This hadn't been a matter of poor driving, lapsed attention, or a random loss of control. In fact, this hadn't been an accident at all. And somewhere out there, now miles away, a killer was still on the road. Hours earlier, four friends and classmates from Ben Smith High School had set off to jam in some last-minute Christmas shopping together. It was Friday, December 23rd, 1988, when 17-year-old Laverne Allen III borrowed his parents' car, a 1971 Plymouth Duster. Smart, talented, and highly dependable, Laverne was a cadet in the ROTC program, and upon graduation, he aimed to join the Air Force with goals of becoming a pilot. It was a perfect fit for him. He appreciated the order and discipline that came with a career in the military, and now, with graduation just months away, his lifelong dream was coming to fruition. Sliding into the driver's seat, he pulled out from the driveway of his family's Mobile Street home, making the quick one-mile trip to Cliffwood Drive, where he'd pick up 17-year-old Darius Bannerman, a student who excelled both in the classroom and on the basketball court. Key clubs, student affairs, French and computer clubs, Darius dreamed of a future in medicine, and he wasn't afraid to put in the hours and work necessary to achieve that goal. As Laverne pulled up, Darius came striding out alongside his cousin and fellow classmate, 17-year-old Kenneth Newkirk. Opening the passenger side door of the two-door vehicle, Darius cranked the front seat forward as Kenneth climbed into the back. It had been a long day for Darius. Basketball practice had taken a lot out of him, and so he slumped down slightly in the seat, leaning against the doorframe and closing his eyes as Laverne and Ken laughed and joked about his need for a nap. Just one more stop, Laverne promised, and they'd be on their way. They had a 90-minute drive ahead of them, and Darius was free to try a nap, as much as that was possible in a car with three other teenagers laughing, chatting, and cutting up. 19-year-old Kenneth Dungy was standing at the curb of the cul-de-sac of the apartment complex on Huntley Court, his signature smile beaming as he saw Laverne rolling slowly towards him. A basketball star and talented woodworker, Ken was excited to go on to college where he would pursue degrees in drafting and engineering. If anyone had the ability, it was Ken, who had wowed his teachers and been awarded for his skills in industrial arts, as well as his strides on the court. The two exchanged hellos as Laverne stepped out, Ken climbing in the back seat beside Newkirk. The four friends had decided to take the shopping trip together, both as a way of picking up last-minute gifts and to hang out on the unseasonably warm Friday afternoon. Who knew how many more weekends they'd have together once they all went off to college and for Laverne, the military. They wanted to do something different. Rather than hitting up local shops they'd already exhausted, the group planned to drive 90 miles out of Greensboro to Crabtree Valley Mall in Raleigh. It was supposed to be a fun adventure, but they'd never make it to the mall. Instead, their fun trip would become a nightmare, and before the sun set that evening, one of them would be dead. The trip was a straight shot, taking Interstate 40 eastbound for the vast majority of the drive. I-40 had recently finished up construction work, extending its eastern reach as far as Garner, with the western edge connecting to US 15501 near Chapel Hill. They set off at approximately 2 p.m., and for the most part, it was a normal drive. Darius falling asleep off and on as the others talked about everything. Girls, school, Christmas, college, all of the things that are important to teenagers on the verge of becoming men and going out into the world on their own. There was traffic, but it was moving along smoothly on the two-lane road as Laverne clicked on his blinker and merged into the passing lane to the left, bypassing a few cars that were exiting. The black Plymouth sailed through the Hillsboro area, crossing the halfway mark at approximately 2:55 p.m. At this time, Laverne was still in the left lane as they began passing a series of cars. 38-year-old Grady Alexander was heading home, riding in the right lane as the four friends slowly moved up beside him. He later explained to Unsolved Mysteries, quote, "When they went by me, they were doing about 60, 65. They were carrying on like kids do, high school kids. There was a lot of movement in the car. I looked over and one of the boys saw me looking at him. He grinned and waved. The car kept going." End quote. Not long after the black Plymouth passed Alexander, he caught a glimpse of a blue flash in his side mirror. Turning his attention to the rear view, he spotted a blue car moving up at a high rate of speed in the left lane. As the vehicle came side by side with Alexander, he glanced over and saw two people inside, a male behind the wheel and a woman in the passenger seat. He described the car as moving fast. He estimated the speed to have been between 75 and 80 miles per hour. As the car zipped past him, Alexander glanced down and noted the vehicle as being a Monte Carlo with Georgia license plates. While he didn't get a good look at the driver, he later commented that the man had long, stringy hair that looked dirty, and the female passenger had either blonde or strawberry-colored hair. No more than 5 minutes after the four friends had passed Alexander, the blue Monte Carlo, which had whizzed by, was now rapidly approaching the black Plymouth. At first, no one noticed, until Laverne glanced in his rear view and spotted the Monte Carlo bearing down on them. Looking towards the right lane, he couldn't get over. Traffic had accumulated as they were now approaching the busier Chapel Hill area. He assumed the driver behind him would slow down, but if anything, he seemed to speed up aggressively, to the point that he could no longer even see the car's front grille in the mirror. Ken Dungy turned, looking out the back window, and saw the blue Monte Carlo was mere inches from their rear bumper. They assumed the guy was just in a rush and tailgating to get them out of the way, but he never fell back and instead kept driving his car so dangerously close to them. Unsure of what to do, Laverne, Dungy, and Newkirk were beginning to get concerned, and the two backseat passengers started telling Laverne to get over, get out of the guy's way. It wasn't just his manner of driving that had them worried, but the look on his face was ominous. Darius, who had been asleep to this point, was awakened by the commotion, and later explained to the News and Observer, quote, "I remember turning around and seeing this guy's face. It was just a fierce look. He appeared angry. It was a crazed look." End quote. Finally, Laverne stepped on the gas and sped up, increasing his speed to over 70, but that did little to satisfy the driver of the Monte Carlo. As the black Plymouth began to create some distance, the unknown man sped up too, and then smashed his bumper into the car. All four reacted as their bodies jerked forward, panic now beginning to overcome them. Darius, when speaking to Unsolved Mysteries, explained the fear of the situation, saying, quote, "He bumped us, and it didn't seem as though this was all happening. It just seemed, it was like horror. Traffic was moving fast. and we speeded up to get away from the guy. The man driving the Monte Carlo, he had a look of like we had done something personal to him. It was just surreal, just crazy, that mad look. It just looked like he wanted to hurt us. End quote. In desperation, Laverne pressed down harder on the accelerator, passing above 80 miles per hour, but the blue Monte Carlo wouldn't budge. It stayed on their bumper as though it was magnetically drawn to them. The driver edged closer, the vehicle slightly weaving from side to side as he periodically tapped the brakes, the rubber squealing as he seemed hell-bent on staying with them. Then they felt it again, the bumper of the Monte Carlo smashing into them. Laverne struggled to keep the vehicle straight as the pressure of the hit and the speed at which they were moving made even the slightest overcorrection a possibly lethal shift. Moments later, the unknown driver pulled his vehicle up slightly to the left of the Plymouth, his front bumper lined up with their rear tires. Turning his wheel, the driver sideswiped the car, causing the rear end to slightly fishtail as now all four friends were screaming. Finally, seeing an opening, Laverne pressed the pedal to the floor and zoomed forward, shifting out of the left lane into a gap of traffic on the right. There was a collective sigh as they expected the man to fly by them, but he wasn't done, and instead, the unknown driver sharply turned his wheel, veering into the right lane and continuing to tailgate them. They thought he wanted them out of their way. They figured he must be out of his mind, but it seemed the driver of the Monte Carlo wasn't just looking for an open road. He was aiming to run them right off of it. Multiple witnesses would later report that the female passenger appeared to be arguing with the driver, perhaps protesting against his violent actions. Both vehicles flew past exit 270, U.S. Highway 15501. The blue Monte Carlo was still on them, the driver's face etched with an undefinable look of anger and rage. Two other drivers riding on the interstate saw the scene developing in front of them and noted that the Monte Carlo was just inches off the Plymouth's bumper, and both vehicles were traveling in excess of 90 miles per hour. Within 60 seconds of passing the exit, both cars whipped beneath the overpass of Old Chapel Hill Road. The unknown driver pressed his accelerator hard, the Monte Carlo lurching forward as the engine screamed. For the final time, he slammed into the rear of the car, and Laverne completely lost control. The black Plymouth went careening off the side of the road, tires screeching towards a steep embankment. As the front of the car dipped downward, the rear tires rolled off the asphalt, and shocked witnesses watched in horror as the vehicle flipped, rolling three full times before crashing down to the earth, where it rolled down the slope, landing inverted in a dusty patch of grass. At some point, no one's ever precisely determined, both Darius and Newkirk were ejected from the vehicle, slamming into the ground not far from where the car would ultimately land the final time, 293 feet from the spot where it had been rammed. The air was thick with the smell of burnt rubber, engine oil, and steam as several terrified drivers pulled to the side, jumping out of their cars and running towards the wreck to see if they could help. One vehicle, however, hadn't stopped to render aid. The blue Monte Carlo pulled onto the shoulder at almost the same time. The driver's door popped open and a white male stepped out. Long, stringy brown hair dangled about his face as he seemed to stare towards the accident, almost as if he was frozen in that moment. Suddenly, the passenger side door opened, and the blonde woman climbed out, screaming at the man and waving her hands. To this day, no one is sure if she was yelling at the driver for what he had done, or if she was urgently encouraging him to get back in the car and take off. Either way, without saying a word, the man coldly turned, walked back to the Monte Carlo, slammed the door, and sped off into the afternoon. It was 3:25 p.m., just 90 minutes after the four friends had set off on their trip. At 3:30 p.m., multiple units of the North Carolina Highway Patrol were on the scene alongside EMTs and the fire department. As early arrivers began triage protocols, the first victims reached were Darius and Newkirk, lying in the grass. Darius had sustained head trauma, resulting in a fractured skull, and his wrist was broken. He was stable, but seriously injured. Newkirk had taken the brunt of the accident against the left side of his body, breaking his leg and several fingers on his left hand, in addition to cuts, scrapes, and bruises. He, too, was badly injured, but not critical. Things were far more severe in the wreck as both Ken and Laverne were pinned inside the car, strapped into their seatbelts. Laverne was trapped in the front seat, the collision having collapsed part of the car down onto him. He was severely wounded, jagged metal cut through his leg down to the bone, nearly severing it. He was drifting in and out of consciousness when they reached him, for the most part, unaware of what was happening. Realizing that they wouldn't be able to free him themselves, the fire department would have to try and cut him from the wreckage. At the same time that Laverne was being treated, EMTs checked on Ken Dungy, but he had been killed instantly. The 19-year-old with so much promise had been killed in a violent, vicious, and senseless crime perpetrated for completely unknown reasons, and was still strapped into his seatbelt in what was once the rear of the car. Sergeant R.W. Eiley of the Highway Patrol, who would go on to be the lead investigator, would carry the tragic burden of having to tell Ken's family that he was gone. It took nearly 45 minutes to free Laverne from the car, and while that was one major obstacle tackled, his condition was critical. The severe wound to his leg had caused a tremendous loss of blood, and while both Darius and Newkirk had been taken away in ambulances to nearby Memorial Hospital, he would instead be loaded onto a helicopter and flown northeast to Duke University Hospital, where he would immediately undergo surgery in an attempt to save his life, and if possible, his leg as well. For investigators, a call they believed was in regard to a horrible accident was now the subject of a death investigation that was clearly pointing towards homicide. Over the course of the next 12 hours, they would interview multiple witnesses, some who had seen the crash, some who had seen the lead-up to it, and others who had witnessed the entire horrible series of events. Almost all of the witnesses had seen the car and described it similarly. The vehicle was said to have been a mid to late 70s Chevrolet Monte Carlo, medium to dark blue, with a half vinyl top and Georgia plates. No witnesses were able to provide a reason for the man's violent and aggressive driving, and for most it seemed, he had done it for no reason other than he wanted to. In terms of the suspect himself, witnesses described him as being a white male in his mid to late 20s with long, dirty-looking brown hair and a light brown mustache. No one seems to have gotten a good look at the woman passenger, with her being described only as white with blonde or strawberry hair. Tony Williams, a witness to the accident, told investigators that he was driving eastbound behind both vehicles when the attack occurred. He was completely blown away by the blatant acts of the unknown driver, telling the News and Observer, quote, "He bumped into him twice before he ran him off the road. I think they ought to catch him and hang him," end quote. Unfortunately, police didn't have a lot of information to work with. They issued a be on the lookout for the blue Monte Carlo and passed on the suspect's description, but by the time things had really gotten moving, the unknown driver had had plenty of time to get out of the area. Then there was the question of motive. While several officers from the Highway Patrol felt that this could have been as simple as road rage gone too far, others believed that there was something more disturbing at the core. Given that the driver was a white male, and that he had directly targeted a vehicle in which all four occupants were young black men, there came a question of whether or not the crime may have been racially motivated. Investigators weren't quick to specify what they believed might have been the motive, nor, frankly, were they quick to consider what happened to be a murder. The cool response from investigators rubbed a lot of people the wrong way, in the community, in the victims' families, and in the media. Sergeant Eiley, when asked about the likelihood of finding the suspect, explained to the News and Observer, quote, "We don't want to raise false hopes. Given the few things we do have, it makes it very difficult. If one person had taken the time to jot down the plate number, we would have been further along than we are now. Because of that, we have to reach for straws," end quote. While police were working towards identifying a suspect, Laverne was fighting for his life. Darius and Newkirk had been treated and were expected to make a full recovery, though they would spend the holiday in a hospital bed. In the first 3 days following the crime, Laverne underwent three intensive and difficult surgeries. Ultimately, doctors could not save his leg and were forced to amputate just below the thigh. His dream of joining the military, of being a pilot, of serving alongside his fellow cadets had been shattered, and a recently awarded scholarship from the Navy was now up in the air. But Laverne had bigger concerns to face first, namely, learning to walk with a prosthetic leg. He was constantly being monitored by different doctors with different specializations, including hematology, respiration, infectious diseases, orthopedics, and physical therapy. A funeral was held for Kenneth Lynn Dungy on Tuesday, December 27th, just 2 days after Christmas. He was laid to rest in Lakeview Memorial Park. His family was devastated by the loss and angry with the lack of developments in the case. Ken's brother William later stated to Unsolved Mysteries, quote, "I know how it happened, I know when it happened, but I don't know why it happened. Until I understand that, it will never be put to rest," end quote. Anita Wells, a teacher at Smith High School, described Ken as a promising student who could have achieved anything. He had worked as her teaching assistant and was truly skilled in industrial arts. According to an interview Wells did with the News and Observer, Ken had recently finished constructing both a draft table and chair for class and was scheduled to head up a team of students who would be framing out a house for Habitat for Humanity. Miss Wells, though, was more focused on Ken rather than his accomplishments, saying, quote, "He wasn't just my student, he was my friend. I still look for him all the time. It seemed everybody knew him. He was one of those kids who was really friendly," end quote. In a heartbreaking admission, Miss Wells explained that she had been in possession of a large chunk of mahogany and Ken had been asking her if he could have it to carve a chessboard. After saying no several times, Wells finally decided to surprise Ken with the wood, delivering it to his apartment the day he left for Raleigh. But Ken wouldn't make it back home to see the thoughtful gift. The response from the community was immense. Dozens of letters and cards were sent to Laverne in the hospital, as well as to Ken's family. An anonymous business owner donated $2,000 for a reward for the identification and capture of the Monte Carlo's driver. The high school also wanted to help and began organizing fundraising events to contribute both towards a reward for information as well as the cost of a headstone for Kenneth's grave. Benny W. Higgins, principal of Smith High School, told reporters that the school had received many calls from locals wishing to help out in whatever way they could. Discussing the crime with the News and Observer, Higgins lamented, quote, "It's devastating. It's bad enough when you have a young person die, period. But to know it's a malicious act that happened for no apparent reason, it's just difficult to accept," end quote. That year, 1988, came to a close with Darius and Newkirk back at home, still recovering from their injuries, while Laverne was in the hospital, no longer in critical condition, though doctors listed him as stable but serious. For their families, they were glad they were still alive, and for their friends, it gave them a new perspective, how everything could be gone in the blink of an eye. For Kenneth Dungy's family, there was sorrow, hurt, and anger, and an urgency to see justice done, to see the man who had killed their son and brother arrested and charged. But sadly, 1989 would begin with the suspect still free and police struggling to find his trail. In the weeks following the crime, tensions began boiling over for both the families and the local community as a whole, who were beginning to feel as though the case was not being given the attention it deserved. The NAACP got involved, issuing statements accusing investigators of being disinterested in finding the suspect, as well as demanding that a larger reward be offered and that the crime should be denounced for having been racially motivated. It was argued that two investigators working the case had taken vacation several days after the crime, and despite the passage of more than 2 weeks, there were still no named suspects and the investigation seemed to not be going anywhere. In hopes of getting to the bottom of the matter, a reporter from the Greensboro News and Record began making calls. First, he reached out to then-Durham County District Attorney Ronald Stevens. When asked why this case had not yet been labeled a murder, Stevens replied, quote, "Murder is a big word. We're seeing it as a death. We're still investigating the circumstances," end quote. When asked whether or not the State Bureau of Investigation would get involved, Stevens explained that if the current investigators requested their assistance, they would receive it, but up to that time, the 7th of January, there was no plan to involve the SBI. While D.A. Stevens' answers were not what the reporter was hoping for, his next contact was Sergeant Eiley of the Highway Patrol. Eiley explained that they had recently followed up on a tip, which led them to begin investigating a Georgia man who had borrowed his father's blue Monte Carlo and was present in the area the day the attack occurred. While the potential suspect's name wasn't given, Eiley noted that the man was currently wanted in connection with felony embezzlement charges, but his whereabouts were unknown. When asked about the possibility of this crime having been racially motivated, Sergeant Eiley responded, quote, "The mere fact that the accident involved people from two different racial backgrounds does not mean it was racial," end quote. He went on to explain that they were still trying to determine what exactly occurred that day, and while it surely could have been racial, their utter lack of evidence outside of witness reports did little to clarify any potential motive. It was noted in that same article that Sergeant Eiley, who is in charge of the investigation, is black and understood why a racial motive was suggested, but he had to work with what he could prove, and until he could find the suspect, he couldn't prove anything in regard to motive. For some, that answer provided comfort that the case was being handled properly. For others, they still argued that the case was being put on the back burner and the potential racial motivation was being ignored. The NAACP issued a letter to then-Governor Jim Martin's office demanding that both the SBI get involved in the case and a $15,000 reward be set. In response, the governor's office issued a $5,000 reward for information leading to an arrest and conviction. For Laverne, Darius, and Newkirk, they weren't sure what exactly was going on with the investigation. In an interview with the News and Record, Laverne agreed that there seemed to be a lackadaisical approach, pointing out that police had not yet set up any of them, nor any other witnesses, with a sketch artist to create a composite. Instead, a crude sketch being circulated had been drawn by one of the victims himself. What drove the man to do what he did that day was something everyone struggled to understand. When Laverne's father was asked, he replied, quote, "It certainly seems strange someone would deliberately cause this kind of havoc, then stop a car and look at what happened, and then get back in as if it were an everyday occurrence," end quote. By Monday, January 9th, investigators had received approximately 30 phone tips from people who believed they knew the driver's identity, and they were working to check them all out. While most of them were dead ends, there were two which showed potential. Sergeant Eiley explained to the Wilson Daily Times, quote, "We have two people that we're now trying to get up to interview. One is in the Atlanta area and one is in the Raleigh area. We just want to try and determine their whereabouts on that day at the time of the accident," end quote. I should note, one of these men was the same man who has been previously discussed, having borrowed his father's car. While this was good news in terms of trying to track a suspect, additional information surfaced which would cause outrage for the community as well as the victims' families. The Burlington Daily Times conducted an interview with Darius's mother, Mary, at which time it was revealed that the Highway Patrol had approached all three survivors and asked them to take polygraph tests. Many felt this was an investigator's way of trying to say that their story wasn't true or that they were leaving something out, despite corroboration from multiple witnesses. All three families refused the polygraph request, and according to Mary, the police didn't push the issue. When asked about this, Sergeant Eiley explained that they believed the man in the Monte Carlo had forced their car off the road and caused the accident, but that with so little information to work with, they were hoping to clarify the record. He also pointed out that while the three survivors all stated they were wearing seatbelts, the fact that Darius and Newkirk had been ejected seemed to contradict those claims. The thought process was, if they weren't telling the truth about one detail, could there be more information that they're concealing? For most people, whoever was wearing a seatbelt or possibly lying about wearing one was far less important than finding the man who had caused Ken's untimely death and Laverne's leg to be amputated. Eiley later stated that requesting the polygraph was less about truthfulness and more about detail, calling it an investigative technique to ensure no details were left out from the story. When asked about the crime, Laverne was at a loss, replying, quote, "I don't know why he did it. I have no idea. It was just a malicious act, I suppose." Maybe he had some problem. He must have had some problem. We didn't do anything to provoke it. End quote. 2 days later, on Wednesday, January 11th, investigators announced that they had managed to track down one of the cars they'd been looking for in Georgia. DeKalb County police were dispatched to the man's home where they located a blue, mid-70s Monte Carlo with Georgia plates. However, they couldn't find any signs of damage which would be consistent with the accident. Sergeant Anderson of DeKalb County later stated that the vehicle had been examined and ruled out, though Sergeant Eiley stated that photos of the car would be shown to the witnesses to see if they believed it was the same vehicle. He also explained that while the vehicle might have been cleared, they were still looking to speak with the man who had been driving it. When asked about the slow speed of their progress, Eiley told the News and Record, quote, "We're trying to find him. You have to be deliberate about these things. Haste isn't going to solve anything." End quote. On Friday, January 13th, Sergeant Eiley told the News and Observer that they had managed to track down one individual they'd been seeking and were able to rule him out. The man, who was not named, lived in Raleigh at the time and bore a similarity to the composite image, as well as having driven a blue mid-70s Monte Carlo. However, this man delivered furniture for a living, and his job was able to confirm that, at the time of the incident, he was on a furniture delivery truck and could not have been involved. Asked about the status of the case, Eiley told reporters that there were 5 investigators working it, 2 who were from the SBI, and they were working in 2 teams. Police began circulating the drawing of the suspect this same day, hoping that someone might recognize the unique-looking individual, described as having prominent cheekbones and a light-colored mustache. Eiley went on to explain that it was their belief the car they were looking for was a medium to dark blue 1976 Chevy Monte Carlo. 2 weeks later, on Friday, January 27th, 1 month and 3 days since the crash, Laverne was finally released from the hospital. He arrived at school dressed in his ROTC uniform and was welcomed back by his classmates, who gifted him with a plaque honoring his courage and determination. Chief Master Sergeant Frank O'Hara, Laverne's instructor, was in awe of the cadet, telling the Burlington Daily Times, quote, "He's still squadron deputy commander and will be. He will be out there on the field with us. Nothing is going to hold him back." Other than frustration for maybe a moment, he started talking about the future right away. "That's not a kid there. That's a man." End quote. Both Darius and Ken Newkirk showed up at the cadet meeting to show their support for Laverne, and while for the 3 survivors their lives would never be the same again, they were slowly adjusting back to their routine. However, as they moved forward, the investigation was stalling out. A month later, in late February, Lieutenant Richard Holden of the Highway Patrol explained that they had, thus far, tracked down every lead and they had all been dead ends. They received information from all over the state, from the mountains in the west to the coast in the east, but none of the men whose names were given fit the bill. It was Holden's hope that someone would come forward with information, and perhaps they might hear from the female passenger in the Monte Carlo that day. Holden explained, quote, "We're hoping this female party feels guilty about this. We've had other cases where someone starts to think about it, and they think it's time to come forward. Sometimes people think something they have won't be significant, but it may in fact be significant. If they have information, they should call us." End quote. In hopes that it might help, eyewitness Grady Alexander agreed to go under hypnosis supervised by the SBI to try and remember the license plate information from the Monte Carlo. Unfortunately, this effort only resulted in a partial number, which didn't match any registered Monte Carlos in the state of Georgia. Police received a tip about a man driving a blue Monte Carlo with front end damage, but when they began investigating the driver, he didn't fit the description of the suspect and also had a large, thick beard, one which investigators didn't believe he could have grown in the time since the crash. Soon, the gaps between new leads and new information began growing larger as media reports began coming out less and less often. In May, Darius and Laverne received their high school diplomas, graduating with an eye on the future. For Laverne, his plans had shifted dramatically. The military was no longer an option. And while this had been a lifelong dream, he took it in stride, deciding that the world can change in an instant, and he had to move forward. He instead would matriculate at Virginia Tech. Darius was focused on going to NC State, from which he hoped to attend medical school. While the scars and broken bones had healed, the lingering effects would never fully mend. Laverne was still struggling to adjust to his prosthetic leg, noting that stairs he could once fly up now took a lot of time and effort. As for Ken Newkirk, while his broken leg had fully healed, he noted he couldn't run as fast as before the accident, and his athletic abilities had been impacted. He also found himself nervous around any fast-moving cars, the speed a reminder of the intense trauma. In June, Ken Dungy's sister Terry graduated from Smith High School and was the first annual recipient of a scholarship named after her brother. For their mother, Marcella, it was a bittersweet day. While she was proud of her daughter's achievements, she grieved for the loss of her son. She later spoke with the Charlotte Observer, explaining, quote, "There should have been two of my children graduating, and seeing only one hurt very deeply. It's a void in my life, and it's not going to go away." End quote. Following up with investigators about the status of the case, reporters were told that while it was still being worked, it was no longer being worked daily, and unfortunately, the more time passed, the less likely it would be that they'd manage to find and charge a suspect. It was a long, hot summer, and while life went on for the survivors and their families, the loss of Ken was still a sore wound made only more painful by the rising likelihood that the man who had killed their friend and caused Laverne to lose his leg was never going to be found. In October of 1989, the persistence of a student and friend of the four teenagers finally reaped the benefits of nearly a year of hard work and dedication. LaVon Tillman wanted to help in some way, and so she had begun a letter-writing campaign. She contacted national television shows and magazines, such as Arsenio Hall, Ebony, People, A Current Affair, Inside Edition, America's Most Wanted, and Unsolved Mysteries. While she hadn't heard back from the vast majority, Unsolved Mysteries was interested and sent a producer down to interview the survivors, witnesses, and law enforcement. Finally, it was announced that they would film a segment on the case, scheduled to air in the 18th episode of their second season. When asked why she had worked so hard, LaVon explained, quote, "Laverne and Darius were very good friends, and as far as I'm concerned, they had never done anything to hurt anyone. I hate to see someone hurt them and get away with it." End quote. The segment officially aired on January 31st, 1990, more than a year after the crash. The response was broad and immediate. Police received more than 300 calls from tipsters who believed they either knew the driver or someone who looked similar and drove a similar car. The calls came in from more than seven states and provided investigators with a lot of different angles to examine. Unfortunately, none of the tips provided led police to anyone who they could put in a blue Monte Carlo on I-40 that Friday afternoon. Sergeant Eiley explained, quote, "After the television show, there was a tremendous response from all over the country. We systematically went through each one, and we will continue to do so until the case is solved. We have interviewed people from Canada to Florida, but we have not found anything that would connect them to this particular incident." End quote. By December, the two-year anniversary of the horrible and atrocious crime, the three survivors were putting the pieces back together. Speaking to the Charlotte Observer, Laverne discussed the current state of his life, saying, quote, "I think about it sometimes. I have good days and bad days, but I don't have the bad days as often. I miss the ROTC. I enjoyed it because of the discipline and order and the way everything was done in an orderly fashion. I have friends in Saudi Arabia, and it makes me feel funny because that's what I wanted to do." End quote. While Laverne had gone on to Virginia Tech, he eventually left the school and returned home to attend one closer, the physical and mental strain having been too much for him to overcome at that time. According to him, the first few weeks were difficult. The buildings on campus were spaced out, and long walks were a challenge on his prosthetic leg. Despite those challenges, Laverne pushed on, and within 6 months of the amputation, he was able to walk unassisted. He still drives a car, so long as it's not a manual transmission, And while he was unable to continue his summer job as a lifeguard, he got back into the water and began swimming again. He just takes his leg off to do it. He was determined, no matter what, to go for his goals and not let anything stand in his way, especially his own doubts. Darius was pre-med and doing well in school, while Newkirk had recently graduated high school and was pursuing a degree in visual communications. For someone who hadn't necessarily given his all in school prior to the crash, he felt a renewed vigor and was determined to make every second of his time mean something, though he admitted he remains haunted by his memories of that horrible day. The loss of Ken still hurts for the three friends who hope to one day see the man who terrorized them, murdered their friend and forever changed their lives, captured and tried. Unfortunately, since 1993, there have been no major updates to this case, and for the last 28 years, that killer has managed to continue living his life, never looking back at the lives he destroyed. In April of 2003, an anonymous woman posted on the sitcom's online message board alleging that she might know the identity of the driver. Communicating with several members of the board privately, this woman was put into contact with investigators. She claimed that the killer might be a friend of her brother's, a career criminal who had been in and out of prison for assault, fraud, burglary, and robbery. Allegedly, this man told the woman's brother that he had been on unsolved mysteries and was wanted for murder in connection to running a carload of teenagers off the road. While this woman later had a phone conversation with police, she also posted to explain that she'd done all she could, and it was up to investigators now. Whether they found the tip to be unfounded or couldn't develop enough evidence to link the suspect to the crime is unknown, but there's yet to be an arrest or even a publicly named suspect in this case. 2 years later, Darius Bannerman himself appeared on the board after finding the posting from a Google search of his own name. Touched to see so many people still invested, Darius wrote the following, quote, "I am 34 years old now, and the car accident was 17 years ago. To answer the question, no, the person who ran us off the road was never caught. I have forgiven the evils of the person who attempted to harm the four of us. My update is that I am a successful manager at a pharmaceutical company, married with a one-year-old. Laverne Allen is a computer engineer and is married. Kenneth Newkirk, my cousin, is a graphic designer and is also married. Thank you for your support, and keep writing in to places like these. The person who did this will pay, one way or another." End quote. Police would still like to locate the unknown driver and his unidentified companion. While details are not extensive, the suspect is described as being a white male who had long, dark, stringy brown hair, prominent cheekbones, and a light brown mustache. At the time, he was believed to be in his mid-20s, which today would put him in his mid-50s to 60s. His female passenger has been described only as being white and having blonde or strawberry-colored hair. At the time, the suspect was driving a medium to dark blue 1976 Chevy Monte Carlo with Georgia plates. It would have sustained damage to its front end from the incident and may not have belonged to the suspect. He may have borrowed it or perhaps stolen it prior to committing this heinous crime. More than 30 years have passed since Kenneth Dungy, Laverne Allen, Darius Bannerman, and Kenneth Newkirk were targeted, harassed, and assaulted, and then violently driven off the road, causing a horrible accident that cost Laverne his leg and took Kenneth Dungy's life. While time moves on and allegedly heals all wounds, there are some things which can never fully mend until the truth is revealed and justice delivered. Four teenagers, attacked without provocation, became the victims of a senseless and terrible crime. While three have gone on, they'll never forget that day, nor the friend they lost, and the angry, hate-filled face of the man who did it. Darius, Laverne, and Ken have found careers, married, had children, all of the things Kenneth could have done. But those possibilities were stolen away from him, his dreams erased, his achievements dismissed, his life stolen. For his family, the ache never subsides, the pain never goes away. What might he have become? An engineer as he dreamed? Would he have married and had children or traveled the world and never settled down? These are questions we'll never know the answers to, because of the mindless acts of a ruthless killer who may be out there today, still riding along I-40 until the next car gets in his way and he decides to strike again. Marcella Dungy, Ken's mother, was asked about the loss of her son and her hope for justice. She replied, quote, "The roughest time is still not over. Some days are fine and I'm able to go on. Other days, I'm low. Whoever it is, they're not doing themselves any good. I believe this is on their mind constantly and that soon they'll have to come forward. I just have to be patient. I know in my heart this person is not going to get away with it." Simply Safe is an award-winning home security system, so you know it's engineered with the latest technology you want to keep your family safe. But what really sets Simply Safe apart is its people. Highly trained security experts who are always there for you when you need them most. Those are people who truly care about keeping you safe. When an alarm goes off, a person who cares is there for you with a phone call to make sure you're okay. When an emergency happens, a person who cares is there for you by getting fire and police responders to your front door right away. Even if you're just having a problem setting up your system, a person who cares is there for you with friendly chat and a quick resolution. The bottom line is, when you need the most, Simply Safe is there 24/7 with people who care and experts trained to not only keep you safe, but to make you feel safe. It's one of the many reasons U.S. News recently called Simply Safe the best home security of 2021. To learn more about how Simply Safe can protect you and your family, visit simplysafe.com/trace today to customize your system and get a free security camera. You also get a 60-day risk-free trial, so there's nothing to lose. That's simplysafe.com/trace. A while back, I was searching for a puzzle game that could give me a real challenge, something that requires more than the same simple strategy time and time again. The more I looked, the more I wondered if I'd ever find what I was looking for. Then I found Best Fiends, a mobile puzzle game that finally offers up refreshing challenges. I love how Best Fiends is always changing, providing me with new and unique challenges that leave my brain feeling like it's run a city marathon. Best Fiends is so much more fun than other matching puzzle games. You know, the ones where all you do is smash candy over and over. In fact, it's almost too much fun. I still can't stop playing. Not that that's been a problem, since Best Fiends literally has thousands of fun puzzles to solve. I'm already on level 1,350, and there's so much more to go. Lately, I've really been enjoying the challenge of hunting down the masked vigilante, while collecting flowers and, of course, upgrading and adding to my ever-growing army. That's one of the things I love. Best Fiends is always bringing in new challenges and fun collection events. It's never the same game twice, and I never know what I'll be up against the next time I play. So are you looking for a matching puzzle game with fun, interesting challenges, frequent updates, and a steady flow of new features? Download the 5-star rated puzzle game Best Fiends free today on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R. Best Fiends. It was a simple plan. Get together with friends, drive into Raleigh, hit the mall for last-minute Christmas presents, and head back. Thousands of people had the same plan, and for the vast majority of them, they made it home without incident. Tragically, for Kenneth Dungy, Laverne Allen, Darius Bannerman, and Kenneth Newkirk, their fun Friday afternoon became an inescapable horror. One of those nightmares where no matter how fast you run, the monster keeps gaining. Most of us wake up screaming, but for four teenagers in 1988, there was no sudden awakening, no quick escape. Instead, they were driven off the road, two sustaining bad injuries, one severely hurt, and their good friend killed. You can try to come up with a reason, but none will explain away a senseless and violent act without cause or provocation. The terrible truth is, sometimes, there isn't a reason. Not everything has a complex line of thought behind it. Not every atrocity can be attributed to a distinct plan. Some people are just evil, driven and satisfied only by bringing pain, torment, and death to others. They revel in the terrible acts they've committed, take pleasure in others' suffering, find joy in the misery they spread. These are the monsters we all learn to fear, the storms we try to survive, the terrors we long to evade. Unfortunately, sometimes you find yourself on a collision course with the devil and there's no light to be found. How many of you drive on an interstate or highway every day or even weekly? Whether you're going to work, school, on a trip, or to the store, each time you climb into the driver's seat, you're entering a dangerous world where you never know if the person behind you is a mild-mannered commuter or a psychopath who could snap at any moment. Have you ever had a brush with road rage or even been guilty of it yourself? Tailgating, brake checking, obscene hand gestures, and threats of violence. In the moment, it seems somewhat innocuous, just blowing off steam. But what if that person riding beside you pulls out a gun, tries to run you off the road, decides that the road belongs to him, and he has every intention of pushing you out of the way? You're sailing along at 65 miles per hour in a 2,000-pound steel cage, and the only thing between you and infinity is how fast and how smart you can react to what might be coming around the bend, and sometimes even that's not enough. Of course, that's not what happened here. The four friends hadn't done anything to enrage the man zooming up behind them. They'd never even seen him before. They made the mistake of being in the left lane when he came along, and for whatever reason, he felt this was a great affront to him that warranted not only trying to intimidate them with his tailgating, but multiple slams into the rear bumper, until finally he sent the car careening out of control, off the interstate, over an embankment where it rolled several times, resulting in serious injuries, an amputation, and a death. Kenneth Dungy was a talented, bright high school senior with the whole world ahead of him, and in the blink of an eye, seemingly on a whim, this psychopath decided to push and push until there was no room left on the road. This case is different from a lot of cases covered here on Trace Evidence. There isn't a great mystery about what happened. We have plenty of eyewitnesses who can attest to that. This isn't a case where someone vanished or was murdered and now we're left trying to put the pieces together and determine what exactly happened. There's not a long list of potential suspects or persons of interest. There's no jealous ex or angry coworker. Instead of trying to determine who had a motive to commit this terrible crime, what we're left trying to determine is what the motive was in the first place. What led to this atrocious act that ended one young man's life, forever changed another's, and continues to haunt the memories of all who survived? However, even if we nail down the motive with absolute certainty, would that bring us any closer to finding the man responsible? Probably not, because this crime appears to have been random, at least in terms of how it began, though whether or not that random aspect carries through or was replaced with a targeted assault based upon a vile mindset is another question entirely. So let's begin with what we know and try to work our way through this chaotic and confusing crime. All four friends were living in the Greensboro area, nearly an hour to the west of where the attack occurred. According to Darius, Laverne, and Ken, they'd never seen the man behind the wheel before, nor had they had any encounters with him on the highway that day, which could have served to provoke someone who was clearly an unbalanced psychopathic personality. Grady Alexander, a witness on the road, saw the guys pass him before the Monte Carlo emerged. According to him, they looked like they were having a good time, and when he glanced over, one of the kids waved and smiled. Certainly not the kind of behavior you'd expect to send someone over the edge. Moments after they passed, the Monte Carlo went flying by Alexander, who noted the color and model, as well as estimating that it had to have been traveling between 70 and 80 miles per hour. So it appears whoever the unknown driver is, his aggressive driving and excessive speed was already underway before he even came up on Laverne's car. Since the first time I learned about this case, the question that has bothered me has been, what happened to make this guy change from aggressive speeder to violent killer? According to the survivors, they did nothing to antagonize or provoke the man, and there's been no evidence provided to say that they did. He came up on their bumper and rode it hard for several minutes before, in an apparent move of frustration or intimidation, he revved his engine and slammed into them. I think up to this point, you could surely make the random incident of road rage theory fit. This guy's just a maniac, driving like he owns the road, and I personally feel like it didn't matter what car was in his way that afternoon, his behavior likely would have been the same. Where everything changes is when Laverne is finally able to change lanes. Had the driver just flew by them at that point, You might be able to write it off as the violent behaviors of a clearly troubled person, but we know that's not what happened. He had won. They moved. He got what he wanted. But for some reason, he decided that wasn't enough. He wasn't through with them. And so he sped up and veered into the right lane behind them, continuing his threatening and stalking attacks. So what was it? What made this guy go from wanting the road clear in front of him to deciding he was going to push the limit? Once he was behind them in the right lane, he continued to ride their bumper, as he had been for several miles. Everything comes to a brutal and deadly conclusion when the driver decides to hit them again. And it's this third and final bump that sends the car swerving out of control, flipping over and rolling down the embankment. Police estimated at the time of the accident, Laverne was traveling at approximately 80 miles per hour. At that speed, it's honestly a miracle that anyone survived. So, was that what he'd intended? Was this a guy who was looking to possibly kill everyone in that car, or cause a major pileup had they veered left instead of right? Was he planning anything at all, or was he just doing whatever the hell he felt like? One of the most confusing facets of this case is what the driver does next. He doesn't speed away, leaving the wreck behind, knowing that police are going to be looking for him. For some reason, he stops. The Monte Carlo slows to a crawl as it rides the shoulder. The driver puts the car in park, opens his door, and walks to the rear of the vehicle, his eyeline directed off the side of the road, surveying the hellscape of twisted metal and broken glass that he created. In a matter of seconds, he forever changes four vibrant lives, ending one of them. So why stop? Why look? Why stand there seemingly entranced? Was he proud of his actions and wanted to reap the aftermath? Was he surprised, not expecting things to go that way? Was he just high out of his mind on something and didn't know what the hell he is doing? Frankly, if we found this guy tomorrow and asked him why he did this, I don't think he'd have an answer, but he might be able to tell us why he stopped. It doesn't ring true to me that he stopped to take in the view and revel in what he'd done. It sounds more like he was caught off guard by how out of control things had gotten, and perhaps, for just a fragment of a second, what little conscience exists in his mind came screaming to life long enough to give him a second of clarity, enough to realize the gravity of what had just transpired. According to witnesses, he doesn't say anything. He doesn't even move much. He stands there still as a statue, just watching, almost like someone who's in shock. Have you ever done something tremendously stupid, something that easily could harm another person, or maybe did? And for a few seconds, you're just slack-jawed staring and wondering how the hell things went so wrong? Maybe there was a touch of that as well. Hell, maybe it was some kind of combination. He gets out to see what happened, realizes what he's done, and is both disgusted and proud of himself as only a sick and twisted individual could be. Or maybe he's just psychotic, evil, the type of person who stopped to see if he managed to kill all of them instead of just one. All we know about the next seconds is that the female passenger comes out of the car, starts yelling at the driver, and then he gets in and speeds off, never to be seen again. We've never been given an account of what was said, assuming anyone could make it out. But you have to ask yourself one simple question. If the woman was telling the man he was crazy, he was wrong, she can't believe what he's done, would she have just willingly gotten back into the car and driven off with him? I suppose that depends. Maybe she's afraid of him. Maybe he threatened her, or she was just too scared to stay behind and face the consequences. Or maybe they were in the middle of doing something illegal and she didn't want to get popped for that. Unless she comes forward someday, we'll never know. But after more than 30 years, you're going to have a hard time convincing me she's got any saving grace, since she'd never had the courage to pick up a phone, send in a letter, or leave an anonymous tip. When we go through these cases, I'm typically not surprised by the horrors committed by the assailants. It's those people who protect them with their silence that really perplexes me. I couldn't live with myself if I had the power to deliver some form of justice and chose not to. And I don't give a damn who the guy is to her, boyfriend, father, brother, whatever. Why would you not only protect this monster, but still want to be around him? I'll never understand that. Turning back to motive, I don't think it's simple. For whatever reason, something was going on in this guy's life that day and he was looking to take his anger out on someone, anyone. Whether it was because Laverne didn't get out of his way fast enough or he felt his intimidation wasn't working, He decides to follow through, and in the end, someone dies. To me, this crime shifts from random to targeted once the lane change occurs. But the question which has stirred up controversy is why he changes lanes. Did he do it out of anger, seething and wanting to threaten the guys further? Or was it race-driven? Four black teens in a car, one white driver in a rage. It's difficult for me to process. I've never understood the ignorance of hating someone based on nothing more than the color of their skin. Someone you don't know who's never done anything to you. The world is full of bad people, but they come in all shapes and sizes from every color and ethnicity. It is tragically ironic that in a world that craves to praise diversity, perhaps one of the largest commonalities across all races is that every group has its share of abhorrent and irredeemable people. It's incredibly hard to know the why when you don't know the who, but I certainly don't think racism is out of the question. It was broad daylight, he was inches off their bumper, and he had both Ken's faces in the rear window looking at him. There's no question he was aware of who was in the car. But the question is that why he pushed harder, or would he have done that regardless of the occupants? We can't know that answer, and unless this scumbag is found, we likely never will. I suppose that's part of the problem. If I told you this was completely random and just some violent psychopath going off the ragged edge, it sounds plausible. If I told you he kept going because he's a racist piece of garbage, that also sounds plausible. If I told you he's an equal opportunity piece of trash who would have done the same thing to any random car that got in his way that day, it's plausible. Is there any actual reason at all? Or is motive just something we seek out in all situations to try and make sense of the horrors people can willfully do to one another? I don't presume to know why this guy did it, why he pushed it, why he changed lanes, and why he killed Ken, maimed Laverne, and injured Darius in Newkirk. I wouldn't be surprised in the least if this guy was some closet Klan member who spews ignorant racist bullshit all day long and committed this crime purely because he saw four black teens in a car and that was enough to justify murder to his sensitive little broken brain. I also wouldn't be surprised if this guy was a raging violent criminal who's been involved in beating, robbing, murdering, raping, and abducting people based on nothing more than his own interests in that moment. To me, it's not so different from looking at any number of serial killers who have been captured or are still wanted. Why did the Zodiac go from targeting couples on lovers' lanes to a taxi driver? Did he hate all couples? Did he hate all taxi drivers? He struck without provocation, without reason, because he wanted to. David Berkowitz targeted his victims so long as they fed into his fantasies so that he could get off on it later. But did that mean he hated women and couples too? A killer is going to kill. Sure, some have types, they plan it out, they're methodical. Others are more random, spur of the moment, seeking the satisfaction of the kill more so than the physical or psychological characteristics of the victim. Psychology has given us tremendous insight into why people kill. Some do it for money, some for fame, some out of anger, frustration, or jealousy. Others are driven by something more, a perfect storm of psychological and physical issues which culminate in the creation of a psychopath. Some people don't see anyone but themselves as real people, and their conscience never learned to speak. We all want answers, we all want to know why, but the reality is sometimes there is no answer, not one we can understand, not one we can quantify. Some horrible things have been done for no more reason than when a child hits a sibling and you ask why, and the answer is, I wanted to. Sometimes they just want to do terrible things. There's only one way to ever have the answers here, one way to see justice served, one way to be able to look this waste of skin in the eyes as he is sentenced. He has to be identified, located, and charged. Now, barring the possibility that this human cesspool hasn't already exited this mortal coil, perhaps at the hands of someone else or in the process of trying to harm another, he's not unreachable yet. He'd be between the ages of 50 and 65. Still plenty of good years for him to spend rotting behind bars in a small cell, with fleeting glances of sky being his only sense of freedom and independence. He took away Ken's life. He stole away Laverne's dreams. It's time for him to face the consequences, to be called out for the monster that he is, and for every waking moment of his life to be spent under lock and key, following someone else's rules, silenced behind concrete and steel. 32 years is a long time, but let's face it, we're not dealing with a brain surgeon here. He's told someone about what he did. He's gotten drunk or high and rambled on and on about how Unsolved Mysteries covered his case and he's wanted. Assuming that he can actually use technology without having to have someone do it for him, he's probably going to find a way to listen to this episode, to revel in being the center of attention, to glorify himself further through all the damage he's done. That's what cowards do. They prey on those who can't defend themselves and beat their chests like they're really accomplishing something. You forced a car off a road. A car driven by a 17-year-old with what, a year, maybe 2 years experience driving? You're the type of guy who would kick the crutches out from under an elderly woman and think you're tough. In reality, though, you're weak and pathetic, hiding in the shadows hoping no one recognizes you, which I have no idea how no one has yet, because if that composite drawing even remotely resembles you, somebody started off with a raw deal and it's only gotten worse. Maybe that's why you've got so much anger. I imagine it's frustrating going through life looking like a 10-cent caricature drawn by an artist with no depth perception or understanding of human anatomy. Seriously, and I'm not trying to be that funny here, but if you haven't looked at this guy's composite, you really need to. It looks like if you ordered a Matthew McConaughey Pez dispenser hoping for Interstellar or Dazed and Confused, and you got Dallas Buyers Club. Actually, that's probably too complimentary for this guy. For those of you who were living in the South back in the 80s, think about all the guys you knew. Do you remember one with terrible, permanently filthy, stringy dark hair and a horrible brown mustache? Big cheekbones, large forehead, bulbous chin? He'd have been somewhere between 20 and 30 in 88. He may have driven a mid-70s blue Chevy Monte Carlo with Georgia plates, or maybe he borrowed that car from someone. Hell, maybe it wasn't even his and he stole it or swapped license plates in a parking lot. The car is less important than the man. I imagine if you knew this guy, he'd be hard to forget rather than remember. He's probably been in and out of jail, petty crimes, never a career but a string of unsteady jobs. There's a good chance he's still out there, and if the composite is accurate, he's probably still pretty recognizable today. All it takes is one call, one email, one text message, and this long 3-decade wait for justice can finally come to a close. Nothing can ever be done to bring Kenneth back, nor can it return Laverne's leg or assuage the grief that still lingers in the hearts of those who knew and loved Ken. Not everything in life can balance out, but you can sure as hell try, and I believe that the effort is what really matters in the end. Unfortunately, without someone speaking up, a direct confession from the man himself, or a miraculous revelation of evidence, the I-40 hit-and-run murder of Kenneth Dungy will remain open, unsolved, and very cold.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
If you're looking for more information about this case, Unsolved Mysteries did a short segment covering it. The Charlotte Observer, Greensboro News and Record, and the Raleigh News and Observer did the most extensive reporting. If you have any information about this case, please contact the North Carolina Highway Patrol at 919-733-3911. You can also call Durham Crime Stoppers to report anonymously at 919-683-1200 or by visiting durhamcrimestoppers.org. What do you believe happened? Tweet me at TraceEvPod, message me on Instagram at TraceEvidencePod, email me at TraceEvidencePod@gmail.com, or comment in the Facebook group. Trace Evidence would not be possible without support from amazing listeners like you. And now I'd like to take a moment to thank our fantastic Patreon producers, Alicia Lorraine, Anne Bertram, Aurora K, Bacon Bits the Cat, Brittany Bivens, Christine Greco, Krista Colvin, Dave Allen, Denise Dingsdale, Diane Dyson, Eric Sumpter, Guillerme Pinto, Heather Louise, James, Jen Treb, Jennifer Winkler, Joni Berkowitz, Kara Moreland, Marla Wright, Melissa Brakeisen, Nick Mohar Schurz, Orange Patches, Quinn McBreen, Roberta Jansen, Sarah Levonen, Sarah Mascaratolo, Sarah Lyons, Travis Skepko, Stephanie Joyner, Stephanie Eve, Tom Archer, Tom Radford, Tracy Woods, and Walter Jansen. Your contributions to Trace Evidence are invaluable, and your support of the show is both appreciated and extremely humbling. If you're interested in supporting Trace Evidence and gaining access to exclusive merch and ad-free episodes, please visit patreon.com/traceevidence or go to trace-evidence.com and click on the support option. That's going to conclude this week's episode. I want to thank you for listening and for tolerating my stuffy-nosed voice this week. If you haven't already, please consider rating the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. 5 stars would be greatly appreciated, but it's up to you. Share these episodes, spread the word, and maybe together we can help bring justice to those who have been deprived of it. Thank you all once again for listening, supporting the show, and for being the best listeners a podcaster could ask for. Until then, I hope you'll join me next week for another unsolved case on the next episode of Trace Evidence.
Hello, it is Ryan, and I was on a flight the other day playing one of my favorite social spin slot games on ChumbaCasino.com. I looked over the person sitting next to me, and you know what they were doing? They were also playing Chumba Casino. Coincidence? I think not. Everybody's loving having fun with it. Chumba Casino is home to hundreds of casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere, even at 30,000 feet. So sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com to claim your free welcome bonus. That's ChumbaCasino.com and live the Chumba life.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.